Today on Rockin' the Suburbs.
The first time a band in the underground where people weren't just nodding their head and like, you know, enjoying it. Like they were screaming at the band the lyrics at the top of their lungs. Like you couldn't hear the band.
Hi, everybody. Patrick here. Foster, that is. And on behalf of Jim Linehan, I want to welcome you to the final part of our interview with Chris Slusarenko. Big thanks to Chris and Bob Peterson for setting this up, agreeing to it, and being such a wonderful guest. And Bob asking such great questions. So fun to have participated in this. And I think we've got it all squared away now with the editing. We had a few problems with the sound and the recording, but I think we've got them all ironed out, knock on wood as I tap my head. So we'll get you to the third part of this conversation very shortly. I just want to remind everyone really quick that if you're listening to this on the day it drops in the parlance of our times, this will be September 18th, 2025. That gives you 3 days plus to get in your new music picks for August 2025. Just get those in to us via the usual channels. And thanks to everyone who has already done so. Much appreciated. We will start new music on Monday, September 22nd. But tomorrow, we got something really fun coming up for you. I think you're going to like it and maybe even be a little surprised. It should be really cool. So with that, I want to turn it over now to the rest of our conversation. You're going to hear Dr. Bob Peterson asking a question about a music documentary. There's a little bit of music documentary chat here at the beginning. Then we're going to get into a whole bunch of music talk about Eyelids and Boston Spaceships and Sprinkler. So with that, here is the last part of our conversation with Chris Slusarenko.
Do you think the documentary that sheds light on the negative aspects could actually be good for the band, negative publicity? For example, like Dig with the Dandy Warhols and the Brian Jones sound. I mean, I can't help but think that movie yes. launched their careers.
Oh, it was the first episode we did, right? We had to. And I had one of my employees at the video store was their tour manager, right? So I had him come on as a surprise guest, right? During Guided by Voices' last tour, Brian Jones' Town Massacre opened for us. So I knew those guys a bit. So, but it's such a, yeah, that was such an amazing documentary because originally it was going to be a TV series for MTV. So I was given a VHS 30-minute cut. That was like episode one. I was like, this is going to be the greatest TV show of all time because it was pre-Road Rules. It was pre like really reality stuff. But I was also like, well, where do you go? Like, how do you make a series out of two bands? Like, what can you tell? So it was smart to do a movie. But yeah, I think that we all, it's just kind of jaw-dropping when you see how things unfold, you know? So if you see the Brian Jonestown Massacre having a fight in the backyard after playing sitar and singing songs about love, you know, it's just, you can't write it, you know? And there are certain, you know, I'd love, you know, I haven't seen, I don't think there's like a Cheap Trick documentary. I would love to see that.
Yeah.
There will never be a Replacements or a Husker Du documentary, obviously. And, you know, those are complicated stories, but they've chosen not to be told. And so, but yeah, I think when things kind of fall apart as a viewer, you feel so safe because you're like, I'm so glad I'm not in Europe.
Yeah.
With Anvil right now, you know, because we've all been in situations like that where we're like, where's the promoter? Where's the train? What's going on? We're never going to get home. And then it just feels like it's never going to end. Like time just goes, like you're stuck in this moment forever. And of course, the next day, you've got lodging, you've got food, it's fine. But in the moment, right. When things are spiraling, and of course, you can imagine, guided by voices, plenty of nights where we're like, where's everyone? What's going on? Where's the hotel? You know? And then you're like, oh, I made it safe. I don't know how I did that. So, but yeah, I do feel like I don't mind. I mean, I haven't seen too many documentaries that are just like a total put down of a band. Like they're making fun of them. I feel like most bands are cagey and kind of, you know, they can smell it, you know. Have you seen anything like that that's just been cruel?
No, not really. I don't know.
Not really, no.
I think that would be a really, yeah, that's a different type of film. And so, and obviously in Dig, they had to get everyone's permission. And, you know, and they then had to go, that's like when I had Travis on, the tour manager, he said, I learned so much from seeing that film. He's like, it's a great film. It's not the truth. He's like, we had lots of good time. The film is told out of order. They put things in different things. So it makes it look like it's building up to this. And he's like, yeah, the band was a mess. But like, she didn't include the successes, the things that were going on, how we got along, how we could actually function. And he's like, I learned that at that point that never to trust a documentary.
This is not music related per se, but the Paul Rubens documentary, there's a lot of struggle between who gets to tell his story right there within the documentary. Yeah. Yeah.
Out of the gate too.
Yeah.
You know, like right in the first few minutes, you're like, okay, Paul is setting this up, you know, and the back and forth and the fact that it wasn't going to come out, you know, he wasn't sure up to the end, you know, like after all the documentation. And so that is an amazing documentary, I thought. I just, again, learned so much about him that I didn't know. I had the Pee Wee Herman early stuff, like fan club stuff from when he was on David Letterman. I taped it all. I was obsessed. Had the picture disc. But I didn't know anything about his college life or him looking like he could have been in Warhol's factory. I was like,
I know.
Who's this gorgeous nerd who's making these art films? Like, of course he had to succeed, but the way he succeeded was really lopsided too. It was great. And again, it could have been a music documentary. He could have been this amazing songwriter, and the same beats could have been in that, you know. Here's me young, here's me trying to find my you know, people and college and then, you know, being bigger than the other members and having to cut people loose and getting signed. I mean, it's all there. It just was a Pee Wee Herman story instead.
Yeah. Chris, I wanted to switch gears a little bit and ask you a little bit about a couple of music questions I had.
Sure.
So we've got a couple of big Boston Spaceships fans in our listening audience, and they both had a couple of questions, but I think they essentially boil down to this. Is there any Boston Spaceship material that was recorded that wasn't released?
Okay. So Boston Spaceships, for listeners who don't know, was... So after Guided by Voices wrapped up in 2004, Bob, you know, obviously was making solo records with Merge, but he obviously liked side projects and other things. And we had done two records as the Takeovers, which was my music and him singing on it. And then we did a Carbon Whales EP, which was me writing this post-punk music. And it was incognito, super fun. And he just was like, at this point, he's like, we should do it with my music. I wasn't, you know, in a funny way, I wasn't in Guided by Voices long enough to really make any move in a way. Like, I played on a couple records, but I was really frustrated because the songs had already been written when I came in, you know, not all the bass lines and stuff, but I didn't get to do something from the genesis. And my whole thing with Boston Spaceships was to kind of honor the old way. Let's like you send me the cassette, the drummer will hear it once and play it twice, just like on B-1000. Like, we don't have enough time. And then I can hang things on it. we'll get it back to Bob. And it worked. But what it meant was that for one of the first times ever, Bob used everything that we recorded.
Oh, wow.
And that wasn't always the case. And of course, the order would switch, except for Let It Beard. That was the double album, the last one he did, was the only one, one of the few records he ever did where the first song was the first song and the last song was the last song. And
oh,
it was
really?
Split
wow.
Into four sides. Yeah. And then, you know, that was fun to do because I was like, I'm going to have a special guest on each side. And I didn't tell him, like, Colin Newman from Wire was going to be on it. He'd just be like, sounds like Colin Newman. And I'm like, that, it is Colin Newman. And he'd be like, oh, sounds like Jay Mascis. I'd be like, it is Jay Mascis. I was like really wanting to blow his mind. He put out the Let It Be demos. So you can kind of hear
yep.
what, like how often hard it was to articulate. Some things were like, I get it. This is a hit. And other things like German Fields of Shadow, I would just be lying in bed at night being like, it's the last song. I don't know what to do.
Yeah.
And then I just was like, what if I put the Cherub Butthole Surfer drum beat behind it? And then I put some horn and I just like a drone. I'll make it a drone. And then I found it. Times and he would be like, I don't want it to be easy, but yeah, that was it, you know. And we put out that okay. double live thing, and but yeah, sadly there was no other all the meat got used off that body. So
can you talk a little bit about your band Sprinklr?
Yeah, so it was funny. So Sprinklr, I'd been in like bands like Swamp Dick and Death Midget, like these really noisy, butthole surfery, touch and go, weirdo things. And that's what we did. We were that band and played with so many amazing bands, Flaming Lips, Soul Asylum, you know, Killdozer, Dinosaur Jr. But then that ended because, you know, 5 years is a long time. And Sprinklr was the first band that I played guitar in instead of bass, and the first band that I kind of really started singing. And I met some other people. My brother, who was in the other bands with me, was in it. And it, just right away, you just meet people who are like, yeah, I like Husker Du. You're like, okay, we're in a band, right? And that was it. And you don't know them very well. You don't know their style. It's just like, that was the one thing you connect on. And then 5 to 6 months later, you're on Sub Pop. It was so weird. They came to see a show that no one was at with the Afghan Whigs at a little club called the X-Ray. And Jonathan Podman was like, yeah, you guys ever think about putting out a record? And we're like, no, I've never thought of that. He's like, well, give me a call. And he handed me his Sub Pop card. And I was like, oh, hell. But this was also the period where Sub Pop owed Mudhoney money, Nirvana money. Like they were, their cover issue of The Rocket in Seattle said Sub Plop. And it was about how they'd bankrupted the company. And they were the only, Jonathan and Bruce were the only two people left. They were taking the Greyhound bus down and with sleeping bags and sleeping on our floor to tell us, yeah, you should be on Sub Pop. It was really fun. I was like, they were only 4 years older or so, but they felt like adults. And we talk about bands and it was really fun. And so we were like, we have nothing to lose. We've never made a record. Let's do it. But in between the time of us signing, you know, we were going to go record with Butch Vig at Smart Studio. Nevermind comes out. All of a sudden, like, Butch Vig is off the table, but we still did go out and record it smart with his other engineers and stuff. And he was around. He just couldn't touch anything. And then it was like, you'd see Bruce and Jonathan, and they're no longer sleeping on floors. They've got a really nice penthouse when they're visiting Portland. And it was surreal. We played with Nirvana the day their album went gold with Mudhoney. And to see an audience, the first time a band in the underground where people weren't just nodding their head and, like, you know, enjoying it. Like, they were screaming at the band the lyrics at the top of their lungs. Like, you couldn't hear the band. I remember staying next to Jonathan just being like, this is so weird. And the naivety of being like, we've won. It's over. It's going to be changed. It's music like this is going to be around forever. And then, like, 2 years later, be like, eh. But basically, the band just, it was, there was so much pressure from Sub Pop at a certain point after we did the record and our follow-up to, you know, just be better than we were. And we just, it was too much. We just didn't get along at that point. And you're young enough where you're like, well, screw you. I'm going to start another band. And you just do, right? You know, it's like, but I did. It was heartbreaking. I remember Bob Mould coming home one day, and Bob Mould had left a message on my answering machine. He looked up my name in the phone book on a layover to Japan to tell me how much he loved the Sprinkler record. And then we broke up and we all went down to see Sugar's first show in Portland together. And we're all together, you know, we're no longer a band, but we're like, well, we got to go together. You know, we're okay. And we meet Bob Mould for the first time. The first thing Bob Mould says to me is, you broke up a really good band. And I'm like, nice to meet you. I was so bummed out. I was like, well, like, so did you. It was called Husker Du. You know, like, I wish I would have done that. But I was just like, I didn't know what to say. I was like, so yeah, it was a time and place. And I was really glad I got to experience it, but really glad that I had all those years of not caring about success, you know, in the 80s or whatever, so that when that happened, it was a bubble, and realizing it was a bubble instead of maybe starting a band in 94 and being like, hey, maybe I can get on a label, or maybe, you know, I can buy a house like Mudhoney. It's like, nah, that's right. Really rare air.
Across the sails.
funny because I loved, obviously, like, beautiful music. I loved R.E.M. and Teenage Fan Club, but I just wasn't in those bands. I was in these aggressive, you know, punky, kind of grungy bands, loud rock bands. And I was into things like Die Kreuzin and stuff like that, you know, like, and so so with Eyelids, the exciting thing about, it's frustrating to be in Eyelids when you're older because you're like, oh, it's so good. I mean, Peter Buck told us, you guys would have been big in the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, or the aughts, but you started it in the 2010s. And we're like, yeah, we know this, Peter. But I was never in Eyelids. I was never in a band that, this is the first band I've ever been that had harmonies. And that's exciting to me. And so I some of the songs for Eyelids, I tried in other bands and no one could crack them. It wasn't the right people. Like, it was too aggressive. It was too, they're like, I don't really get it. So the first song, Seagulls in the Submission, that we ever put out, like, no one, I kind of knew it in my head, but I just wasn't with the right people. And when John and Jonathan and myself did those Boston Spaceships records, it could get pretty, right? Even though I wasn't singing on it. And we were always like, you know what? Someday we should do it. And when that ended, I just kind of held them to it. And we, you know, basically wrote the first Eyelids record over a weekend, recorded it like 2 months later over a weekend and just put it out. And, but it's kind of fun to be in something where in my youth, I didn't write all my pretty songs yet. And now I'm like, I don't know where to go. I've done it all. You know, I'm like, to me, it's all new still. But there's still an aggression, like Accidental Falls, and certain songs on our records are pretty rocking. And also live, I saw someone the other day who was visiting from Athens, and they're like, I tell all my friends that your records are really pretty, and then live, you guys are just like so intense. I'm like, yeah, it's kind of great. You know, I kind of like that. So, yeah.
So do you consider Eyelids a supergroup? That's question one. And number two is, who is your favorite supergroup?
It's funny. We got a bit of a tag, but it's at the same time, it's like, you know, we're best known for the bands that we were part of that were big, like, you know, like Polly playing, you know, with Elliot Smith and being on those records, you know, John, like I said, being with Stephen Malcolmus and the Chicks and the Decemberists, you know, myself with Guided by Voices. It's like, people aren't like, oh, I've been waiting for the Chris Lazarenko solo record since 1995. You know what I mean? Like, we've always wrote songs. Like, John had an amazing band called the Maroons and things like that. But it wasn't necessarily like a nationwide thing that people knew who we were. So, you know, for some people, they're like, that's a great group, you know. But it was funny, you know, when Peter and Victor got involved, it was kind of like, okay, we're really stacked now. This is insane. So, yeah, it's but my favorite super group, man, I don't know. Like, what, like, my favorite, like, Cheap Trick is still one of my favorite bands, right? Because they were a super group. Like, it was weird. All the chemistry band, you needed all four of them. They were all height of their powers in terms of what they brought. So, and I love The Fall, which had one member that was constant, right? And same with Guided by Voices, right? And to me, it's like, well, that's a super group because Marky Smith just kept bringing in the right people to do these things. And it's so funny how with The Fall, now I'm just like, yeah, I kind of love it all. You know, I'm just like, it's just, I can't, like, when he goes off and does kind of jangly stuff, I'm there. When he went electronic, I'm there. It's just, I just think it's fascinating. But like, what are some super, like, throw me some super groups and.
-5.
Right. But again, that's a thing where it's Scott. And then like when he plays in Portland, it's like, oh, it's Casey Neal and Peter and, you know, Polly. And then he plays, you know, over here and it's like Linda and Mike Mills. It's like, Scott's the constant, you know what I mean? So I never think of, I always, I'm like, that's Scott's band, right? I never think of them as a super group. So funny.
New Pornographers.
New Pornographers are great. Yeah, absolutely. And again, changing. I always feel like super groups should be constant, though. Like, it's like Paul Stanley, Ted Nugent, you know, like Bunny Carlos and Ricky Lee Jones are together, and they made the, you know, it's like, oh no, they have a name, and it's those four people, and if one of them is out, it's kind of, I don't consider it that, you know. So I know there's a lot of things out there that people have done that I've never heard that are like, oh, these three people got together to make this cool record, right? You know, like Gorillaz, you know, as an example of something that's like, I mean, but it's circles around one person. So in a funny way, those, I like those kind of projects a lot. I kind of like the weirdo savant that then knows how to direct and make these things and people come and go, but you also kind of don't know like what makes it. It's fascinating, you know?
So what's the latest with Eyelids? What's going on?
Well, right now we're kind of spread to the winds a bit. We're all dealing with a lot of parental health issues, yeah. You know? And so it really, you know, every guest I have on the show, you know, we kind of talk about it before we start rolling. It's like they're either in it, they're dealing with it, or they've done it, and or they're dealing with their own health issues. You know, I mean, you know, that, and also we put out like two or three things a year for 10 years, and it just was like so funny to take a year off and realize that, oh yeah, it's still there, like it, you know. And so we've always done a thing where, if we have, you know, three really good songs, let's put out an EP. Why wait? Let's do it before we've overworked it, you know, which was again, a thing I really liked about Boston Spaceships was like, don't overthink it, go from the gut. And we kind of do that with Eyelids, you know, some of the songs on the last record. I remember there's one song called That's Not Real at All, which is about, the lyrics are about Peter thinking he might have seen The Fall perform on the Old Gray Whistle Test the same day that they did, but The Fall wrote about it in their book, the Hanley brothers did. And he was like, it could be real. So I wrote this like fictitious storyline, but the music was really sparse and kind of experimental. And we played it once in the basement after I showed them the song. And then I said, let's not play this again until we're in the studio. Let's record it on my phone one more time. And then let's forget about it. And I'll play it to you. And it worked so well. Everyone's like, I kind of remember that. But they hadn't figured out all their cool parts yet. And got, it needed to be wrong a little. And so, yeah, that was really exciting to do that. So, but I think that we have some songs that haven't been recorded and put out. And we have some songs that have been recorded. Like, you know, that just, we're trying to make sure it's, we can play if we put them out, you know, instead of just like, here it is. And because it's really fun to play live with this band. I mean, I miss crawling under John's legs with my guitar. I miss turning around and seeing him. He did one of the coolest stage moves on our last show in Minneapolis.
I was there. He had the neck of the guitar in his mouth.
I was like, I looked over. He had the neck of the guitar in his mouth and he's swinging it back and forth slowly. And it was like so striking. The photos, you're like, everyone I've showed it to, they're like, never seen that before. And then they're like, my teeth. But yeah. So I miss.
And he held it there for at least a minute and a half or 2 minutes too.
We're a weird band, you know, but we're also like, we're just also trying to entertain ourselves and like, you know, make each other laugh. I remember that night. I think I even said as a joke, and I didn't even know like that anyone would take it seriously, but I said, you know, we're really honored to be the last band to be playing here tonight, you know, and like they would have Eyelids, right? Be the last band ever to play this amazing 7th Street, First Avenue place. And you were like, what? I'm like, no, I'm sorry. Like, it's, I was like, I thought you'd all laugh. Like, all right. Okay. Yeah. Eyelids are the big closer of this, you know, hollowed ground. So, but yeah. And then I feel like I was trying to win people back. I'm like, hey, don't be mad. That's Eyelids great. In a nutshell, you know, so.
That's great.
Why do you always wear sweaters on stage?
I run cold. So I do have like a temperature deficit. And also it just, it's security thing a bit, you know? It's like, whether I wear a t-shirt or a sweater, I'm going to be sweaty. And my wife is from Scotland and she just has the eye for sweat. She's just like, chow. And it's always secondhand cheap sweaters. But you know, I just like it, you know? And, I've always loved sweaters and, you know, Joe will look at like pictures from my childhood and she's like, yeah, you're always just in a sweater, even as a little kid, like, you know, with a striped sweater. I'm like, yeah, I know. So, yeah. But it was funny. I think 2 years ago, the weekly magazine in Portland voted me best sweater collection. And I am like, well, yeah, there's not a lot of competition and this is not a yearly event. So, you know, but I was flattered that people know. And it is, I get people who bring stuff to the show and then I'm like, I'm not a XS sweater size. That was very nice of you. But this is for a toddler. I am not a toddler. I'm a 57-year-old dude. So it's really funny. You know, they're like, I brought you this. I'm like, thank you.
All right. Well, Chris, thank you very much for your time. This has been great.
Oh, thanks. It was really fun to be on the other side. I mean, I'm obviously a very hyper excitable person, but I'm passionate. I get excited about stuff. And yeah, thank you for having me. And again, congrats on, you know, the longevity of what you do and the scope of it. I know, again, I respect the work. I know that it, you know, showing up is one thing, but then there's so much more that goes into it. So, you know, congrats.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, well, this has been great. Let's do it again sometime.
Yep. Thanks again, everybody.
All right.
All right. Good to see you, Bob. Bye.
Thanks.
Bye. Fall now, I'm just like, yeah, I kind of love it all, you know. I'm just like, it's just, I can't, like, when he goes off and does kind of jangly stuff, I'm there. When he went electronic, I'm there. It's just, I just think it's fascinating.